This is Kirk Benrook for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule. Or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138. So who's with me?
I'm Derek Frost.
I'm Karen Rains.
I am Mike Edwards.
I am Sue Perry.
First Day of School. This is a Washington ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. She was a brand new history teacher to the school and had been preparing her first lesson in her mind for weeks. This was her very first teaching job, and she wanted it to go well. The night before classes began, she couldn't eat and tossed and turned restlessly all night. But up early, she was in her new classroom, sweeping the floor, tidying the desks, and putting up welcome signs just after dawn. But finally, finally, the first bell rang, and her very first class came rushing in through the door. They were eager and lively and full of high spirits. She felt her heart lift at the sight of their fresh faces, and soon a lively dialogue between teacher and new students was established. They liked her, she could tell, and they were smart, too. She tossed review questions lightly at them to see just how much information they had retained from the previous grade, and they were prompt to answer. And most of the answers were correct. One particular lad, sitting in one of the front desks, was particularly knowledgeable about history. She was impressed by his answers, and more impressed by the fact that he did not push himself forward as the class know-it-all. He answered quickly and quietly, and let others take their turns. He had bright eyes and curly dark hair, and his smile was slightly impish, and he smiled a lot, soaking in information like a sponge. The teacher smiled at him and tossed out another history question, seemingly at random, which he answered promptly after a pause indicated that no one else knew how to respond. But at that moment, the bell rang. The teacher smiled as she heard it. Her very first class of her very first day as a teacher had been, yes, a success. Then, to her surprise, the curly-haired boy in the front row got up promptly from his seat and hurried toward the door of the classroom without even waiting for her to dismiss the class. Well, that did seem strange. After his polite behavior during the class, she opened her mouth to reprimand him and then gasped as he walked straight through the wall beside the door and vanished. The teacher felt her eyes widen and her mouth go dry in shock. Around her, the living students exclaimed in shock and fear, "Did you see? Did you see?" shrieked one of the girls. "Did you see? He went right through the wall." "A ghost. He was a ghost," the boy sitting next to the ghost shouted, banging the desk in his agitation. There was pandemonium in the room for about 5 minutes, while the students from the first class exclaimed in excitement and fear, while the students filing in for the next class tried to figure out what in the world was going on. The teacher sat on the edge of her desk, feeling slightly faint and dizzy. It wasn't until a student brought her a drink of water that she recovered herself enough to dismiss the class and, yes, welcome in the second class. The new teacher found out over lunch from her colleagues that the school building had the reputation for being haunted by the ghosts of students who had died too young. Footsteps were heard for hours. Janitors reported the sounds of children talking and laughing inside darkened classrooms and sometimes felt invisible presence rushing down the empty hallways. But she, yes, she was the first teacher to see a ghost student in her classroom. The new teacher exited the school after her first day in a thoughtful mood. So, this was teaching eager students, belligerent students, funny students, and one ghost. "I wonder what day two will bring," she asked aloud. And then she shrugged and went home to dinner.
Ghost Handprints, a Texas ghost story retold by S.E. Schlosser. My wife Jill and I were driving home from a friend's party late one evening in early May. It was a beautiful night with a full moon. We were laughing and discussing the party when the engine started to cough and the emergency light went on. We had just reached the railroad crossing where Villa Main Road becomes Shane Road. According to local legend, this was the place where a school bus full of children had stalled on the tracks. Everyone on board the bus had been killed by an oncoming freight train. The ghosts of the children were reported to haunt this intersection and were said to protect people from danger. Not wanting a repeat of the train crash, I hit the gas pedal, trying to get our car safely across the tracks before it broke down completely. But the dad-blamed car wouldn't cooperate. It stalled dead center on the railroad tracks. As if that weren't enough, the railroad signal started flashing, and a bright light appeared a little ways down the track, bearing down fast on our car. I turned the key and hit the gas pedal, trying to get the car started. "Hurry up, Jim, the train's coming," my wife urged, as if I didn't hear the whistling, blowing a warning. I broke out into a sweat and tried the engine again. Nothing. "We have to get out," I shouted to my wife, reaching for the door handle. "I can't," Jill shouted desperately. She was struggling with her seatbelt. We'd been having trouble with it recently. She'd been stuck more than once, and I had to help her get it undone. I threw myself across the stick shift and fought with the recalcitrant seatbelt. My hands were shaking, and sweat poured down my body as I felt the rumble of the approaching train. It had seen us and was whistling sharply. I risked a quick glance over my shoulder. The engineer was trying to slow down, but he was too close to stop before he hit us. I redoubled my efforts. Suddenly, the car was given a sharp shove from behind. Jill and I both gasped, and I fell into her lap as the car started to roll forward, slowly at first, then gaining speed. The back end cleared the tracks just a second before the train roared past. As the car rolled to a stop on the far side of the tracks, the engineer stuck his head out of the window of the engine and waved a fist at us, doubtless shouting something nasty at us for scaring him. "That was close," Jill gasped as I struggled upright. "How did you get the car moving?" I didn't," I said. "Someone must have helped us." I jumped out of the door on the driver's side of the car and ran back to the tracks to thank our rescuer. In the bright moonlight, I searched the area, looking for the person who had pushed our car out of the path of the train. There was no one there. I called out several times, but no one answered. After a few minutes' struggle with her seatbelt, Jill finally freed herself and joined me. "Where is he?" she asked. "There's no one here," I replied, puzzled. "Maybe he's just shy about being thanked," Jill said. She raised her voice. "Thank you, whoever you are," she called. The wind picked up a little, swirling around us, patting our hair and our shoulders like the soft touch of a child's hand. I shivered and hugged my wife tightly to me. We had almost died tonight, and I was grateful to be alive. Yes, thank you, I repeated loudly to our mystery rescuer. As we turned back to our stalled vehicle, I pulled out my cell phone, ready to call for a tow truck. Beside me, Jill stopped suddenly, staring at the back of our car. Jim, look, she gasped. I stared at our vehicle. Scattered in several places across the back of our car were several glowing handprints. They were small handprints, the kind that adorned the walls of elementary schools all over the country. I started shaking as I realized the truth. Our car had been pushed off the tracks by the ghosts of the school children killed at this location. The wind swept around us again, and I thought I heard an echo of childish voices whispering, "You're welcome," as it patted our shoulders and arms. Then the wind died down and the handprints faded from the back of the car. Jill and I clung together for a moment in terror and delight. Finally, I released her and she got into the car while I called the local garage to come and give us a tow home.
Ghost in the Stacks, a Pennsylvania ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. I saw her out of the corner of my eye while I was studying in a remote corner of the second-level stacks in the library. She was pretty, with reddish hair and pensive wide eyes and an intelligent face. I straightened up, patted my hair to make sure it was smooth, and took another look. She was gone. I felt my shoulders sag a bit as I turned back to my books. Oh, well. There were more important things, like studying hard so that I got into medical school when I graduated next year. Still, I kept seeing the girl's pretty face whenever I closed my eyes, and I was still thinking about her as I left the library. A few of my friends shouted to me, and I walked over to their gathering place. "Where have you been, Tony?" my friend Jeff called. "At the library," I said, patting my backpack for an emphasis. "You've been studying?" Jeff asked incredulously. I grinned. "I've got a crack down now so I can get into med school," I replied to his jibe. "Can't always be partying with you losers." That set them off as I had intended and kept the jokes flying until dinner time. Although I didn't admit it to myself, I chose the same spot in the stacks for my studies the following afternoon, hoping to see the pretty girl again. I was in luck. After about an hour, she appeared among the shelves, browsing intently. I noticed that she was wearing the same red flowered dress with a button-down white sweater. She must like that outfit. It was time for me to do some browsing, too, I thought, straightening my shirt and rising casually. I turned to walk into the shelves and stopped abruptly. She was gone. I was astonished. She must be quick, I thought. It had only taken me a few seconds to rise and turn, but in that short time she had managed to move away without my seeing her do so. I walked casually through the stacks, glancing this way and that, trying to spot her again. No luck. With a sigh, I turned back to my seat in my studies, a frustrated man. I didn't see the girl again for several weeks. Then one day, as I rushed out of the stacks towards my friend Jeff, who was impatiently beckoning me to hurry up, I saw her rising from a seat in a far corner. I stopped abruptly and turned, hoping to catch her eye as she moved into the stacks, but she did not turn her head. Ignoring Jeff, who was calling my name impatiently, I backtracked, in the hope of at least walking past her and saying hello. I stopped at the entrance of the stacks where the pretty girl with reddish hair had just walked. There was no one there. I shivered a bit. This was getting spooky. Was she avoiding me? Why? We had never spoken, and I certainly could not be accused of staring at her since I had only seen her for a total of maybe 30 seconds. Shaking my head at the mystery, I went back over to Jeff and exited the library. Later that week, I decided to skip the football game to cram for a big exam. Just about everyone else was at the game, so the library was nearly deserted as I strolled over to my favorite study spot in the stacks on the second level. I'd given up on seeing the pretty girl with the reddish hair. Obviously, some things were just not meant to be.
I was deep into my studies when I heard the sound of books and shelves tumbling to the floor. I leapt up and ran up towards the sounds. To my horror, the pretty red-haired girl whom I'd been trying to meet lay on the floor with books all around her. She was unconscious, and my heart gave a painful thump when I realized that there was blood staining her red dress. And then, right before my eyes, she vanished. I sat down abruptly on the floor, my legs shaking too hard to hold me. I had just seen a ghost. It was then that I remembered the story of the girl who had been murdered in the library back in the 60s. I knew at once that it was her. I had just seen the reenactment of her final moments of life. I buried my face in my shaking hands, feeling a terrible grief at the tragic loss of such a beautiful girl. From what I had heard, her murderer was never apprehended. It made me furious to think that justice had never been served. Slowly, I uncoiled my body and rose to my feet. The aisle between the stacks was empty now, and so was my heart. I was too unnerved to study any more in this deserted place, so I grabbed my books and went back to my room. I saw the girl one more time before I graduated. I was reading at my favorite study cartel when I felt a chill in the air. I shivered and looked up, and there was the ghost of the pretty girl standing a few feet away from me. Our eyes met, and I saw fear and despair in her face. Immediately, my own twisted in sympathy, and I impulsively held out my hand toward her. At the sight of my distress, she reached her hand back toward me as if to comfort me, and she gave me a tiny smile. Then she was gone. In that moment, I knew wherever the girl had gone after her death, she was just fine, and I felt sure that someday, somewhere, her killer would be brought to justice. If not in this world, then most assuredly in the next.
Enchanted, a New Jersey ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. I roam alone in the woods, listening to the enchanted children's voices calling to me. Little girl, come and play. They sing over and over in my ears. Sometimes I hear them from the window of my room. They giggle and whisper words that I cannot make out. They sound like so much fun that I run outside my house as fast as I can and try to catch them. I plunge into the woods, calling back to the children, but no one answers. So I stand still as a mouse, trying to hear where they are hiding. I find it odd that no one else can hear the children. I tell my mother about the game of hide-and-seek that they play with me, but I know she doesn't believe me. She just ruffles my hair and chuckles about my bright imagination. Papa can't hear them because he is too busy reading the paper and going to work, and he says I will grow up to be a writer. One morning I hear the enchanted children calling me from my porch. Sarah, come out and play. I finish my breakfast so fast that the milk spills from my cereal bowl and run outside with my blue smock still dripping wet. Where are you? I call as I run into the woods. I can hear them giggling and footsteps scampering first here and then there. I laugh aloud and follow them uphill and then down. Only my foot slips in the damp leaves and I slide too fast, too fast. I fall backward, windmilling my arms, and a terrible pain shoots through my head as it strikes against a rock. I see a blinding light and then nothing. I hear my name called from very far away. Sarah! Sarah! I open my eyes and sit up, rubbing my hair. Something isn't right, but I cannot tell at first what it is. Then I look at my hand and realize I can see the ground right through it. That's strange, I think, standing up and brushing dead leaves from my blue smock. I look around to see who was calling my name, but I see no one in the woods with me. I notice that the trees look taller than I remember them, and the pathway is overgrown with weeds. I make my way home slowly, hoping Mother can explain to me why I can see through my hands, why the trees are so tall. But someone else is staying at my house. Mother and Papa must have gone away on vacation. I climb up to my favorite tree to wait for their return. After a few minutes, a lady comes outside and calls up to me. She is dressed in strangely in a man's long pants and rough work shirt. I feel shy, so I pretend to be invisible. I see the lady blink a few times and rub her eyes as if she can no longer see me. She goes back into the house, muttering to herself, and pours herself a cup of water. Then I hear the enchanted children calling out to me again from the woods. I slid out of the branches of the tree and run over to answer them. At least they haven't changed. I can see the children clearly now as they play hide-and-seek in the woods. I join their games, laughing sometimes when one of the boys tweaks me on the ear or when one of the girls compliments me on my dress and blue smock. This is fun! But sometimes the enchanted children go away to another place, a place I can't follow. When they vanish, I wander back to my house, wondering when Mother and Papa will come home, or I play in the alley by the woods, though I don't like it when strangers try to talk to me. One day, when the children go away, I follow my nose to the door of a pretty lady who is baking cookies. I peek into the kitchen window and smile at her. How I want one of those cookies! The lady looks out the window and sees me. She smiles and then comes to the front door. I know she is going to offer me a cookie, so I scamper to the door and wait eagerly for her to open it. And when it does, I grin at the pretty lady, but she looks right through me, a puzzled frown on her face. Maybe she is blind, I think, and so I say politely, "May I come in?" right into her ear. Lady gives a start, backs hastily inside the house, and shuts the door in my face. No cookies for me, then. I sigh and go back into the woods and wait for the enchanted children. When the children come to the woods, I am happy again, and we play for days and days. We sing, we dance, and the boys play tricks, and we climb all the trees and puddle out of them. But they only come during the day. The nights are lonely, and sometimes I wait for hours and hours during the day before they come. I like to go to the pretty lady's house and sit on the half wall while I wait. Maybe one day she will offer me a cookie. The lady's grown-up daughter passes me sometimes on her way in and out of the house. Once the daughter asked me where I live, but I was too shy to speak to her. The daughter put some pretty metal cats near the wall where I like to sit. I play with them when I feel lonely and no one else is around. It is beautiful here in the woods. And I like playing with the enchanted children. But often I wish Mother and Papa would come home. I miss them so much, but they never do.
Pilots of Times Square, a New York ghost story retold by S. E. Schlosser. He had just graduated from Harvard University and was living in Manhattan. He loved the city and was beginning to feel at home on its streets. World War II was raging in Europe, and like all other good citizens, he followed the headlines daily and did his part for the boys overseas. Hugging his jacket close, he stood shivering at the corner, waiting for the light to change and wondering where his enlisted friends might be staying on that cold winter night. He hoped they were safe. He shivered, only partially from the cold, and looked around him at the bright lights of Times Square. He never tired of this glittering scene. His eye was caught by two men who were dressed in the uniforms of the Royal Air Force of England. They must be on leave, he thought. The men stopped beside him, glanced quickly at their watches, and then nodded and grinned at him. The taller of the two asked him, in the clipped accent of the British, if this were Times Square. He suppressed a smile at such a touristy question and said that it was. The light changed, and the two RAF pilots fell into step with the Harvard graduate as he crossed the street. The three men fell into conversation together as they meandered along the shining streets. The Brits were thrilled to be in Times Square after all they had suffered in the war. They didn't go into detail about their wartime experiences, and he didn't press them. He just enjoyed their pleasure in the scene, which was marred only by the frequent checking of their watches. Finally, he asked if they had some place to be, but they said they were free for the evening. He promptly invited them to have dinner with him at the Harvard Club, and the RAF pilots accepted with alacrity. The three men repaired immediately to the Harvard Club, where they dined leisurely and chatted late into the evening. The RAF pilots were good company and told many stories, although they glossed over their experiences in the war. They continued to check their watches frequently throughout the night, but he decided it was just a nervous habit they had picked up somewhere, possibly in the Air Force. As midnight approached, the two RAF pilots excused themselves and rose from the table. They thanked the Harvard man for a memorable evening and started for the door. Then the tall pilot turned back and told their host that they had always wanted to visit Times Square, but never had the opportunity. It was strange, the pilot added, that they had to wait until after they were dead, killed in action, when their planes were shot down the night before over Berlin, to fill this dream. The Harvard man stiffened, his eyes widening incredulously and his mouth falling open in shock. He gasped, but could not speak. The phantom RAF pilot smiled sardonically at him, nodded, and joined his friend in the doorway. Then the pilots vanished before the astonished man's eyes, just at the stroke of 12 midnight.
You've been listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.triangleReadingService.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kirk Benroot for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.